Hi, this is Tanya Domi. Welcome to The Thought Project, recorded at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, fostering groundbreaking research and scholarship in the arts, social sciences, and sciences. In this space, we talk with faculty and doctoral students about the big thinking and big ideas generating cutting-edge research, informing New Yorkers and the world. Paul Krugman is a distinguished professor at the City University of New York's Graduate Center, a core faculty member of the Stone Center on Socioeconomic Inequality, a LIS senior scholar, and an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. He previously taught at MIT, Stanford, and Princeton. He is the author or co-author of many academic papers and numerous books aimed at both professional and general audiences, including Market Structure and Foreign Trade, Geography and Trade, The Return of Depression Economics, and Arguing with Zombies, Economics, Politics, and the Fight for a Better Future. In recognition of his work on international trade and economic geography, Krugman received the John Bates Clark Award of the American Economic Association in 1991, the Prince of Asturias Award for Social Sciences in 2004, and the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences in 2008. He is best known to the general public as an op-ed columnist and blogger for the New York Times. In 2011, his blog, The Conscience of a Liberal, was ranked number one of the 25 best financial blogs by Time Magazine. His most recent book, Arguing with Zombies, Economics, Politics, and the Fight for a Better Future, was recently released in paperback format. Arguing with Zombies is Paul Krugman's accessible guide to basic economics and the ideas that basically animate public policy in the United States. Likewise, there is no greater foe of zombie economics, the misunderstandings that just won't die. There is little doubt that Paul Krugman is the most visible public intellectual in the world today from his columnist platform at the New York Times, where he also blogs prolifically. He has also emerged as an effective political polemicist for the ideas of forward-leaning, a generous America that embraces reality, trusts science, and relies on the data. It is such a pleasure and honor to welcome Paul Krugman to the Thought Project as our guest today. Thank you for joining with us today, Paul.
Yeah, hi.
You wrote in Arguing with Zombies that punditry was never part of your plan, and yet you are one of the most prolific public intellectuals in the world today. I have reviewed the history of American punditry, and you remind me the most of H.L. Mencken, the Baltimore newsman who was at his peak of influence during the early 20th century and opined through the Roaring Twenties. While you are quite different in your expertise from him, both of you have commanded the public stage and you continue to do so, which is quite remarkable. You also write that in the 21st century America, everything is political. Is this one of the reasons why you decided to stake out a public intellectual platform?
Well, yeah. I mean, I almost backed into it accidentally because I was known as being a good writer for an economist, which is one of those backhanded compliments, and and was invited to write for various public forums, broader interest platforms. It turned out I was pretty, decent at it. And then, the invitation to write for the Times came out of the blue. I was doing periodic columns for Slate and for Fortune, but then Times, the best journalistic job in the world, and it came out of the blue. And I had intended it to be mostly about business and economics, but it turned out that while I try to keep the focus there, as I said, everything is political. You can't talk about business economics, economic policy, without bringing the hyper-partisanship and the sheer craziness of the American political scene into the story.
Exactly. What I liked about your four rules of punditry: stay with the easy stuff, write in English, be honest about dishonesty, and don't be afraid to talk about the motives. That's very interesting lineup there.
Yeah, I mean, some of it is obvious, but I think people, even in the pundit world, have, and also in the economics profession, have been slowly coming around to accepting some of this. But you know, there was a kind of a norm which made sense in a different time, which was to grant, even if you suspected that the people making certain arguments were not arguing in good faith, that they were not being honest about the facts, and also that they were not being honest about their motives, that they were in fact being driven by various kinds of political and worse motives, you kind of pretended that we were having a genteel debate. And those still happen. There's been a really interesting debate about the appropriate size of the economic relief package.
And, yes, yes.
There are two sides. I'm right, they're wrong, but but both sides are in fact serious people. We agree on the facts. We're willing to take each other. It feels like a vacation. You know, we're managing to visit briefly the land from which we've been exiled. But the fact of the matter is very few important public policy debates are like that these days.
That's true. And I want to get into that in a little bit, your differences with Larry Summers. But let me just also follow up here and say, when reading your book, I hastened to bring in political scientists, but I'm going to. I was reminded of the work of political scientist Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone book, published in 2000, and Thomas Frank, who published What's the Matter with Kansas, which revealed people voting against their self-interest. Yeah. And the second book was published in 2004. It seems ideology, the truth and facts, and the adoption of zero-sum policies by Republican administrations and the growing polarity in Congress really began to fragment and seems to have fully manifested in the Donald Trump administration, embracing failure at both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue while lying about it every day.
Yeah, I mean, it started a long time before Trump. I mean, if you really want to, it really goes back at least to the 1970s. But the moment when I sort of realized that we were, well, I was about to say we're not in Kansas anymore, but actually we are. We're in Thomas Frank's Kansas.
We are indeed.
Yes. But was really with the rise of Newt Gingrich and the extreme ideologues within Congress. And then Bush the second, Bush the younger, was already quite a ways down there. But then, of course, where we are now
makes him look good in
retrospect. Yeah, well, that's what I have to say, you know, a political remark, but it's an amazing thing that the Republican Party has achieved, which is that each successive Republican president manages to make his awful predecessor look good in comparison. So
indeed. Yeah. I think that you're absolutely right. I mean, when you look at the legacy of Reaganomics and the legacies of Reagan have actually been even upended in the most recent iteration of government. But under Trump, it is absolutely remarkable what we have witnessed and painfully watched over the last 4 years and into this very moment. You actually wrote in your book that the biggest threat to Social Security is political. How can the Biden administration strengthen Social Security? I want to hear your thoughts about that.
Oh, I think the main thing about strengthening Social Security is to just not worry about it. I mean, the financial situation, there's probably a shortfall in the Social Security budget. It's even that is not entirely certain. There's, you know, when you're making projections 75 years out, lots
right.
of stuff can happen.
Right.
But we do have an aging population. So there are fewer people of working age per retiree, which,
right.
and since you have a system which is basically one that taxes people during their working years to pay benefits to people after they've retired, that creates a financial problem. But it's not a big problem. It's certainly well within the resources of the United States to deal with it. It's a problem that would require fairly simple legislation to add to the resources of the system it's not all that much money involved, you know. Of course it's trillions of dollars, but we're talking about the U.S. economy here, so it's really not that much money. There's actually in fact a case for making benefits more generous, because the Social Security system it's not bad. I mean, by international standards, our retirement system is actually relatively robust and relatively decent in terms of the incentives it creates, but it is pretty thin living for those who rely primarily on Social Security, and that's actually most people. So, but there's just not a crisis there. It's a made up crisis.
So this is
also segue into the Biden package, but we have two CUNY faculty policy experts, Mimi Abramowitz and Deepak Bhargava, and they are proposing universal social security, delinking it from work, that could bring millions out of poverty. Indeed, Canada, Australia, and most European Union nations already have a child allowance, a universal direct cash payment that is delinked from employment. And also, they point out that ironically, Mitt Romney has proposed a child allowance through Social Security that in some respects is more generous than Biden's, although our colleagues disagree with the plan to pay for it by cutting other anti-poverty programs. But more importantly, Romney's plan builds on existing Social Security system that delivers monthly payments more effectively than the tax system. What do you think about that?
Yeah, a lot of that is a fairly technical issue. Basically, everybody who works pays into Social Security. Right. Everybody has a Social Security number, whereas a lot of people don't actually file income taxes because we do have exemptions, and there are quite a few people who are not making enough money to need to file a return, which means that at one level, the administration looks easier if you do it through Social Security. I'm told by people who do study this stuff that it's not as simple as that, because when you file income taxes, you also provide other information that makes it a little easier to target benefits on people who need them. I don't have a view on that. Okay. But the idea of a universal allowance that is delinked from
work,
For children, definitely. There's absolutely no reason not to do that. It's crazy to think that, do we even want to be forcing parents of young children to work to make ends meet?
Right.
The thing about improving children's lives is it's cheap. Doesn't take a lot of money.
Payoff, and it has a big payoff. Right?
Huge reduction in poverty and misery, more importantly, than for relatively modest amounts of money. At the opposite extreme, a universal basic income for everybody is either going to be vastly inadequate to live on or impossibly expensive. Maybe if there's a future world where robots are doing all the work, we can get there, but we're not there.
We're not close to there yet.
Yeah. Now, the question about retirement is it's a political economy question more than an economics question.
Okay.
And the genius of the Social Security system is that because it looks like a pension fund, it looks like you work and then you receive your rewards afterwards, that makes it very broadly popular. It makes people feel that it's a fair and appropriate system. Now, in some ways, that's a bit of an illusion, because the fact of the matter is that the relationship between what you pay in and what you get out is very nonlinear. It's 90% income replacement for low incomes, and it falls off a lot as it goes up. So the system is, in fact, substantially redistributive. It's less redistributive than it used to be, because it turns out that we now have growing divergence in life expectancy, so that low-income people also die off sooner. But that's another issue we ought to be dealing with on its own terms. And if you were to say, let's replace that with a system that is just everybody is entitled to a basic income when they retire, I fear that the political support for the program would be badly hurt. It's an old line poverty programs are poor programs, something that is kind of that doesn't have that kind of easy political legitimacy would end up being shortchanged. And so I would not meddle with it at this point.
What you're saying. Okay.
So something that's good.
So speaking of people who are staying home to take care of children, anecdotal reports indicate that women workers have become one of the biggest casualties during the pandemic economy, with millions leaving the workplace to stay at home, helping care for the family and support children who are learning from home. Perhaps they will return to the workplace post-pandemic, but again, the pandemic reveals weaknesses in our system, and the lack of access to affordable child care because of high cost is probably the biggest obstacle for women to work. And the existence of actual child care deserts, especially for newborns in New York City. We have a graduate student who's researching this in New York City right now, a student of Janet Gornix. But we are one of the few Western developed countries that does not provide subsidized childcare, except that we do. For in the military, we do have childcare centers 24/7. They operate on a 24/7 basis, especially for a very much married military in the 21st century. I actually worked on that issue when I was a congressional aide. What are your thoughts about this? This is a really big issue in people's everyday lives.
Yeah. So first of all, the story about how the military does it. You know, America is a big and complicated country. It turns out that we have examples of everything. People say Americans will never accept single-payer health care, except everybody over 65 has Medicare.
Right.
People say that Americans will never accept socialized medicine, but the Veterans Health Administration has exactly that. The Veterans Health Administration is a large, completely publicly run health system. Actually, New York City has quite a lot of that itself. And in terms of the childcare issue, this is one of those areas where, and it's not just about the money. It's partly about making it affordable, but it's also about a publicly regulated, maybe publicly run system would be reliable in a way that ad hoc arrangements are not.
The fact of the matter is
you have no really good way, particularly if you're a lower income person. How do you know that your children are being properly looked after? And so the assurance of knowing that there were standards, there was enforcement, that the workers were decently paid would be a huge thing. And the funny thing is we have all of this constant claim on, from the right side of the political spectrum that various kinds of things, tax cuts for corporations, tax cuts for wealthy individuals will largely or totally pay for themselves, almost all of which is nonsense. But in fact, childcare, by freeing women to enter the paid workforce, it probably wouldn't pay for itself completely, but a significant part of it would come back in the form of revenue. It would actually be a pro-economic growth, pro-tax. This is one of those things where the whole way we treat children is completely shameful.
In America, yes.
Yeah.
Agreed. And it's a real issue in New York City, for example. You have these child care deserts. There aren't any caring facilities. They just don't even exist. And this is New York, where, like America, we have a little bit of everything here, but we apparently don't have enough child care providers.
Finally, there's some big expansion of pre-K, but that's
true.
That's not enough. Just imagine, if you're in some rural area,
it would be really terrible, I'm sure.
Yeah,
very difficult for quality of life in every way. In the aftermath of adopting Obamacare, try as they might, the Republicans could not end this popular program. The pandemic certainly has revealed, however, the structural inequality of access to health care that has resulted in the disproportionate mortality experienced in the Black and Brown communities and with respect to poor people in general, who are probably those who have jobs in essential workplaces and are more exposed to COVID. We've seen mass closings of rural hospitals around America because governors chose not to take the Medicaid benefit. For example, in South Carolina and Georgia, just two examples. Do you think that Biden will have political clout? Because, I've heard you speak about this, and of course, I know that there's only maybe the first 18 months that you have a shot to really get your agenda up and running. Do you think you will have enough political clout to further advance healthcare access to all Americans?
Well, if this American Rescue Plan, the big Biden bill, goes through, it contains significant enhancements to Obamacare. There's a significant increase in the subsidies. There are some additional enhancements for the states that have not done the Medicaid expansion to do that. And Medicaid itself will be made through administrative.
The
restrictive work requirements will be disallowed again, as they should never have been allowed in the first place. I don't think we're going to be able to force South Carolina to adopt Medicaid expansion, and that's not going to be in the cards. And the bill is not going to provide a permanent enhancement of the funding for Obamacare, but it's one of those things where clearly the goal is to create facts, as we sometimes say, that just as Obamacare was in place, actually, that required a vote to repeal it, which came close but didn't happen. But there are other things.
Right.
Like the, if you look at look at what they, that Trump tax cut, a lot of the tax provisions in it were set to expire after a few years. Obviously, no intention that they actually would expire. The idea was that it would be impossible that, that Congress would roll over and just extend them. And in this case, for it's a force for good. The idea is that once people have become accustomed to having affordable health care
and these services,
That, you know, it's going to be a long way short. If you wanted a full European style universal health coverage system, it's unlikely we'll get that in the next 4 years, but the but we can get a significant improvement, and you know, making significant progress is really all you can ask for.
So, given that these new revenue lines and sourcing are in this Biden American Rescue Package, and I've heard you speak about it, it's a very big bill. There has been some critics of this. I've heard you speak about some of the things that you would. Didn't think were as targeted as they could be, but there's political support for the $1,400 checks, as you've mentioned. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, but it does seem that Biden did learn from the Obama experience of not going big enough, and Obama tried to negotiate with the Republicans and leaving him really without much effort to be able to really bolster the economy. It's sort of ebbed and flowed, but it didn't really get a big, big boost like this bill potentially can give it.
Yeah, at least according to reporting, during, you know, in the Obama White House, there were certainly economists who did the same math that I was doing and said, this is likely to fall well short. Mm-hmm. And they were told, well, that's okay. If it looks like it's not enough, we can come back for more. And that turned out to be a complete pipe dream.
And because he didn't have the political support.
Right. And Republicans were much more concerned with trying to make Obama a failure than they were with what would happen to the economy. And that was a Republican Party that was a much gentler, kindler entity than the Republican Party we have now. So if there's something you want to see happen, it better be in this bill. It's a big bill. It's a lot of money. 8.6% of GDP, which is
significant.
That's a big thing. That's comparable to I've been actually doing some historical comparisons. That's basically the Korean War is the size of it. Yeah,
it's the size of the Korean War.
And it is kind of like a war because we have an emergency and we need to spend money. And as I've been saying, when you have a war to fight, you don't ask, is this a big enough stimulus to close the output gap? You say, what do we need to win this war? But it's big enough that it's not unreasonable to think that we might have an economy that's running very hot a year from now. Hot enough that maybe inflation picks up a bit.
That you might have to increase the
Well, it can increase interest rates. Yeah. Uh-huh. So if you thought that the relevant question was, are we making the best use of a limited amount of money? Then there are things you might want to scale back. The $1,400 checks, many of them will go to people who probably are not in urgent need. Even the aid to state and local governments, although desperately needed by some states and other states, are doing better in terms of revenue than they expected. As I've been saying, I've been debating with people like Robert Summers, that they're making a category error. They're thinking of this as a question of how to spend a given amount of money, but it isn't. The constraint is political. Even if there are other things you want to spend on, the question of what will make it possible to do these other things we should be doing is a question of politics. And a successful pandemic rescue makes it more likely, not less likely, that we'll be able to do things like spend on
be able to do more.
So
exactly,
so it's a huge bill, no question. It's
a remarkably big
bill.
It's
worth doing.
Yeah. So yes, you pointed out the $1,400 checks is like approved in the 70 percentile of the American public. I mean, it's very popular and it's something that Biden promised. And so, he wants to deliver on it, and this will bode well without question, I think, from the politics side of the question.
Yeah, Democrats won those two seats in Georgia.
Exactly.
Which make all the difference. If they hadn't taken both those seats, none of this would be happening. And both candidates were running on checks for everybody. So how can you not do it?
So given that, I'd just like to hear your thoughts. I mean, we're really talking about America, and we're going to come back to America, but I'd like to hear your thoughts about when you look at the global economy and then like looking at Europe, it does seem that Germany learned from the austerity times after the 2008 global recession, but UK seems to keep relearning their mistakes. What do you think about the state of the global economy and our closest allies and friends in one of the richest parts of the world is in Europe, and then also the role of China, which I want to get into a little bit more?
Yeah, so I mean, to say the Germans are sounding less German than they did last time around, but they're still not doing a whole lot. And Europe as a whole is not doing as much economic support as we are. They have less open unemployment because they've gone more the route of subsidizing people in jobs, but it's still falling pretty far short. The European economy looks like it's going to underperform. We're looking like we're going to have, once the pandemic subsides, which is now looking like I'm pretty hopeful right now, that we're going to have a year of really good growth, and Europe probably not. And that's a policy failure. And it's a mixture of not having shaken off the austerity fever. Mm-hmm. That's a zombie that is still shambling along, eating European brains. And also just disunity. There is no federal government in Europe. That is a real problem in a situation like this. So Europe is problematic. And if we want to talk about Britain, actually, they're doing less fiscal austerity than they did in the past, but they're still cutting social programs. And one of the things
they've cut public universities too, quite a bit. Yeah,
of course. Yeah, and austerity was always, a lot of it was really about trying to undermine the welfare state in the name of fiscal responsibility.
Right.
And
what's
happening right now with the current British government, it's kind of managing to keep on undermining the welfare state even without using as much fiscal responsibility rhetoric. So,
and of course, they lost a lot of EU money too because of Brexit. So,
well, yeah, it's complicated. Brexit is you know, it's disruptive. It's
sure.
I mean, there was a lot of excessive fear mongering about it. In the end, Britain will be a bit poorer, a few percent poorer than it otherwise have been, but it's not catastrophe. At least, you know, it's catastrophe in the short run for some businesses. But the but just Britain. It's interesting because they don't, their right wing is not as openly rabid as ours, but it does continue to try to really undermine the foundations of their social compact.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you said, maybe Europe isn't doing as well economically, but there is a global trend on illiberalism here with respect to democracy and performance and governance of these, you know, alleged to be democratic states. And you really have a problem in Poland and Hungary as an example of really right-wing governments. And it's really interesting how Germany is addressing it or not. They basically have been ignoring Orban, or they've even been dealing with Orban. That's very interesting.
Well, the Hungarian thing, I was an early adopter of Hungarian fears because my next door office mate when I was at Princeton was Kim Shepley, who is an expert on this stuff and was blogging on my site. You know, we've watched a collapse of a democracy. Hungary,
exactly.
I'm pretty close to there in Poland as well. That's pretty scary. Even scarier if you use these various metrics that some of the international comparative political people do, and you ask which parties really are in that illiberal authoritarian space. It would be Fidesz in Hungary, the Polish ruling party, the AfD in Germany, and the Republican Party in the United States.
Yes.
The Republican Party in the United States is practically in the same place as AfD in Germany, which is effectively a neo-Nazi party. So scary stuff.
It is scary. You're right. Yesterday, Secretary of State Tony Blinken gave an interview to Andrea Mitchell at MSNBC, and they discussed U.S.-China policy. And he said, no doubt that China poses the most significant challenge to us of any other country, but it is a complicated one. There are adversarial aspects to the relationship. There are certainly competitive ones, and there's still some cooperative ones too. But whether we're dealing with any of those aspects of the relationship, we have to be able to approach China from a position of strength, not weakness. And that strength, I think, comes from having strong alliances, something that China doesn't have. So I'd really like to hear your thoughts on how the Biden administration is likely to approach China on economic matters. And as you know, they have a practice of engaging in patent theft and espionage to advance their economic interests. And Trump used a tariff policy to punish China, which really actually hurt U.S. farmers. And he propped them up with tax money so that they would vote for him. It seems that Blinken's going to review the tariff policy, and they're going to be reviewing that in the very near future. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on China. And also, a lot of people in the United States, if they're not watching, China's got this Belt and Road Initiative, and it's a huge, and it's you know, kind of referred to as this New Silk Road, very ambitious, and it goes all the way from China down to Europe. It's in the Balkans, which is my research area. They're building bridges and highways, and it's very cheap money up front. There's no democratic requirements to adhere to rule of law, etc. So this is a very new world, and they are a rising power. What are your thoughts, Paul?
Two things to appreciate about China economically is that they're huge. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, depending on which measure you use, China is either the second biggest or the biggest economy in the world. At market prices, they're the second biggest, but not a distant second. And by purchasing power, they're the biggest. You can't treat them as a, you know, they're not a minor player. You can't, obviously we can't bully them, not in the way we could possibly bully a small player in the system. But they're also not good actors, and their intellectual property, which is what you were talking about, is part of it. Industrial policy, clearly favoring industries in an attempt to basically lock in permanent advantage in strategic sectors, is also a big
like issue. rare earth metals.
Well, that's rare earth is a big particular case where and that's very scary, because rare earths are really, it's one of those little seemingly small things that's actually critical. But other things, they've been pushing technology industries. I mean, they're no longer they're a middle-income country, but they have a lot of advanced economic stuff. And the United States needs to not be naive, not say, okay, everything will work out fine. We need to be able to confront that. But we need to confront it, first of all, intelligently. The Trump policy was just incoherent. It was just, what was the problem with China? And it was sort of, well, everything. And the bilateral trade imbalances, which is not the issue.
Right.
It was just, and then all of a sudden, it was a deal where the Chinese were going to buy more of our soybeans, which that, first of all, they didn't actually deliver. But in any case, that was, you know, this was supposed to be about the future. And now we're talking about soybeans. I mean, sorry. Apologies to the soybean farmers, but that's an important industry, but it's not the industry that will rule the future. So you need to have an intelligent policy. But the other thing you need is, because China is so big, the United States cannot be a unilateralist policy.
Right. It's got to be.
We need allies. And of course, the thing is, the great advantage that we ought to have over the Chinese is that we have shared values. It's still the case, although the United States doesn't dominate the world economy, democratic systems that believe in human rights and have shared values do dominate, you know, are still most of the world economy. It's still the case that Europe and Japan and some smaller players are really big force. Now there are a couple of problems with trying to form an alliance. And the point is not to crush China. We're not going to do that. And we don't want to do that. Right. The point is to actually make it clear to China that they need to be a better actor in the world system or face penalties. There are
So you do? Do you do that like in institutions like the World Trade Organization and or at the UN
extent.
And some places, you know, these
Well,
multilateral organizations?
WTO is, you know, the WTO, which was
Right.
really crippled under Trump, restoring
Yes.
that. The WTO
Yes.
is a place where you can do stuff. And if then there are some issues. If we ever get serious now about climate change, there are some questions about whether things like carbon tariffs will be WTO legal. They should be, but there's a possibility that the WTO would rule that they're not illegal. And if that happens, then the answer is there are things that are more important than the trading system rules. So you have to be prepared to do whatever is necessary to bring China into, you know, but, you know, rule-based as far as we can, but make sure that the rules themselves make sense. The problems we have are, first of all, that we've squandered. You know, I talked about shared values, but for the last 4 years, we haven't looked like a country that shared those values. And we need to, you know, rebuild our reputation as an upholder of democratic values.
I completely agree with that.
Then on top of that, you know, some of the people, places we should be allied with are not actually... they need stiffer spines. The Europeans are not actually doing, you know, they've been way too craven in their own dealings with China. Now, that may be in part because that we squandered our credibility. And if we get it back, maybe we could get
maybe
back.
Maybe we'll
to
have some leverage there.
Yeah. But we need to do that. And finally, you know, the whole COVID thing, it did not do great things for our soft power that we mishandled the pandemic so badly and that the Chinese did what it took to bring it under control. So our lack of self-discipline, our lack of competence also hurt our ability. So there's a whole lot of rebuilding. I think maybe what it comes down to is, yeah, we need, Biden needs to be, you know, intelligently tough on China, but it's only going to be effective if we manage to rebuild our own reputation as a country that upholds values and that knows what it's doing.
I'm really glad that you're bringing up soft power, because I don't think that, you know, average people don't think about U.S. soft power in the world, but, you know, Trump did so much damage to our soft power. I mean, he just absolutely gutted it. And I completely agree with you. So the fact that the United States is just is preparing to rejoin the Human Rights Council in Geneva at the UN is a really good sign. They can't do it immediately because of the rotation in the council, but they've already indicated to the UN that they're going to do that. Speaking out on Alexei Navalny is really important. That you saw that when it just as the Biden administration was beginning to take control, they hadn't been sworn in yet and they were already speaking out. So that's really important. And I agree with you about the failure, the incompetence in managing the COVID pandemic, and the fact that we just reached 500,000 dead is just absolutely unbelievable how terrible the consequences are for this incompetence. So Biden is working, I think, 24/7 on trying to turn that around. And that will be important to our external role in the world. I agree.
Let's imagine a year from now, what I think is a fairly reasonable scenario, which is that that we're pretty much back to normal life. It's pandemic is no longer, you know, vastly constraining. Mm-hmm. The economy has grown 7 or 8% over the past year. We're back to something close to full employment. We've re-entered the world of global organizations. And that will be not just the direct payoff in terms of our lives being better, but America will be a much more credible, much stronger player in the world because we turned it around. So that's, we want to do all these things anyway, but it will also help on the international relations front.
Well, I want to ask you a really quick question because it's been readdressed recently in the news, and that's the SolarWinds hack, allegedly by the Russians. And now, during the last administration, Congress actually created an office for a cyber czar that this administration is now setting up. And that actually reveals our vulnerabilities, which is mostly in the private sector, including utilities. And of course, the irony here is that the solar wind companies in Texas, and we've all witnessed what happened in Texas this past week and what you've written about. What are your thoughts on that as a threat and actually a financial or an economic threat to the United States?
It's really hard to know. I mean, we and not my expertise, but obviously everything is networked. And here we are talking together while not being at all in the same place. And so we're a society that basically depends now on the network. And if the network has poor security, God knows what the possible havoc is. That's one whole area. And I have no expertise except that obviously you need to be willing to do this. And you need it. The very first step is to have an administration that is willing to actually point the finger at the people responsible, as opposed to, you know, trying to invent imaginary villains and always excusing the Putin government. I thought you were going to say something different about what happened in Texas, which was the wind and power and all of that, which is...
Well, we can talk about that because we talked about the deregulation, happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole thing. It was we've seen a massive failure of deregulation. But we've also seen what's sort of up the line of my book, we're getting to witness the birth of a zombie.
We had connecting it for me. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, here we are. We had a power failure, which was the result of a freeze that, because of, probably would have wreaked some havoc no matter what. But Texas notably made did not impose any requirements for that would have ensured stability of the system in the event of a natural disaster. And the locus of the freeze was primarily, it affected everything, but it was primarily gas-fired power plants. The plants froze, the pipelines froze, the wellheads froze.
It's a perfect storm.
But the immediate reaction was to say, it was the wind turbines, some of which also froze.
That's true.
The Green New Deal, which hasn't even happened, but somehow or other AOC was responsible for the lights going out in Texas.
Right.
And it's all been shown to be false. And we know that that's not going to matter. Legend that everybody on the right believes from now on. It will be a zombie belief that wind power, renewable energy is why Texas went dark and froze. There are interest groups behind it. Obviously, that if you're in the fossil fuel sector, you want people to do that. And there's ideology behind it. And watch it 5 years from now, we'll still be hearing politicians saying that's what happened.
I still remain curious, though, that why a party and its leaders would buy in and embrace failure repeatedly. Now that's the zombie element, isn't it? Part of it?
Well, part of the answer is because they can. I mean, the Republican Party remains very competitive politically. The 2020 election, the Democrats control of the Senate and the White House, but not by
very
a big
slim.
Margin.
Very slim.
If I can say there is something, I sit in the Stone Center, we study inequality. Right. And one of the reasons we study inequality is not just because of the enormous damage that high inequality does, but also because we think that politically high inequality is a problem, that it undermines democratic values. And there's a lot of talk about the plutocratic aspects of
the upper
of
1%
politics.
Or 3%, depending, yes.
But that's not the only thing that's going on. And what's very really clear now, and this is what you're seeing actually not just in the US, but in these right-wing European parties, is that there's a lot of other stuff. There's a lot of, racial inequality, but also just racial hostility, authoritarian impulses. There's just a lot of stuff. And in a way, the story—
attacks on women, attacks on LGBT people. This is common now.
Yeah. And it's, in a way, the story of American politics is that the plutocrats took over a party, wanted it in order to win elections, exploited all of this illiberalism, all of this hostility, racism, sexism, and then discovered that they were not in control, that it was actually that the people they thought were using them instead. And now we have all of this worst stuff, and it's essentially a minority of the American public, but it's not that small a minority. And given the the vagaries of politics plus the fact that we have a non-representative system in some
electoral ways. System, right?
Yeah, it would be great if policy failures doomed the bad guys, and it certainly makes it easier to
make the case against them, yeah. Right?
As we sort of started out this conversation, the Biden economic plan has incredibly high approval.
Right.
The right is barely even trying to make a case against it, just sort of rolling out some of their canned phrases, but they're barely even trying. And yet, if we reran the presidential election today, it would still be close. So
agreed. You know. Agreed. So on that note, what are the issues you're most concerned about right now?
Well,
what are your big worries?
I'll give you them in temporal order.
Okay.
So the most immediate thing is, look, looking really good on COVID, but after this horrific year, not feeling safe about that. And there's a scenario, mm-hmm. which is that we don't do it. We relax too soon. We allow it to spread. And then the variants come along and the thing mutates ahead of the vaccines and the nightmare. We plunge fully back to the nightmare. That's my big worry for the next year. A little bit further on, well, you know, the U.S. political system is still hanging on by its fingernails. That if we had the midterm elections 6 months from now, not maybe now, but 6 months from now, there's enough voter suppression stuff underway that it would probably mean Democrats would lose Congress and the Biden administration would be completely paralyzed. So there's an immediate political threat, and then the chance of Donald Trump becoming president again is not negligible. So right. So that's the thing, and then beyond all of that, environment,
climate change
is still marching on, and that's existential, and it's the biggest thing, of course, by far.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us about all these issues and about your book, Paul. Thank you again.
Okay, take care.
Thanks for tuning into The Thought Project, and thanks to our guest, distinguished professor Paul Krugman of the Stone Center for Socioeconomic Inequality at the Graduate Center, CUNY.
The Thought Project is brought to you with production, engineering, and technical assistance by Kevin Wolf of CUNY TV. I'm Tanya Domi. Tune in next week.